Well, hello and welcome to another episode of The Capitol Record. This is David Bahnsen. I'm your host of Capitol Record, brought to you by National Review's Capitol Matters. And I am so excited as I've been booking away a lot of great guests over the next 4, 5, 6 weeks. From throughout January, February, I feel like we're really getting some wonderful people are going to come on. And that helps you to know that you get a little break from me. And the better the guest, the less I have to talk. And so hopefully that excites you. Listen, the theme we're going to talk about today is a bit more granular, a bit more specific, a bit more targeted than we often do on Capitol Record. But I can't really say that I think it's any less important, because the approach one takes economically to national energy policy is going to say a lot about what they may believe about economics in general. The juxtaposition of environmental concerns and environmental ideology and a climate policy framework, and how that then is treated in the context of economic considerations, the sort of economic policy context, is at the heart of why we have such a thing as public policy. And more damage can be done by getting this wrong than people can imagine when you're talking about things like heating and cooling and feeding of an entire population. Energy is at the core of what it means to be human, to survive. And we can think of energy in the context of Gulf Streams, private jets, luxury automobiles. We can look at renewable energy sources as something you can just turn on and off, no pun intended. The reality is that the implications in all this get down to the survival of a species. Energy is as old as mankind, and we have decided to politicize and sometimes radicalize what people will say about energy policy, as opposed to rationalizing the trade-offs that exist. My guest today is a gentleman by the name of Samuel Rhines. He spent many years as the chief economist at Avalon Advisors in Houston, Texas, working with some of the largest oil and gas families, entrepreneurs, executives, billionaires, and everything else in the country, and has recently accepted a position as a senior energy advisor at Corbu, where you may remember Renee Ananow joined me last year. Corbu Intelligence, one of the leading macro intelligence firms that delves into all things, this is what we mean by macro, touches currency, touches monetary, touches geopolitical, national security, and they have developed quite a niche, and that's where their addition of Samuel Rhines comes in the area of energy and energy dependence. And so we're going to have a discussion, Sam and I, today about our approach to energy and what's taking place in this whole crazy environment. I think you're going to find the insights very interesting. So with that, we'll jump on into the Capitol Record. So with that said, welcome to another Capitol Record podcast and one of our newest and hopefully by no means last time guest on Capitol Record. Welcome for the very first time, Samuel Rhines. Sam, welcome to Capitol Record.
Thank you so much, David.
So we could go a number of different places today, but I did think we'd be better off just knowing how you and I are probably capable of going into all aspects of economic discussion, that maybe if we do our best to stay focused in the energy space, we can do a little more granular and meaty discussion for the Capitol Record listeners. So do you think we can stay in our lane of energy today?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And we can extrapolate a little bit from there and have a good time.
Sam has now joined one of my infamous dinners with John Malden. Some of you may know that John was a guest on the podcast last year twice.
Sam now works at Corbu with Renee Ananow, who also joined Capitol Record last year. And so Sam and I share some of the same friends and in some of the same themes of interest and conversation topics. And yet what can be very prevalent in our own personal discussions with one another, just as much as in this very podcast where we're talking, is that we can go all over the place because, you know, one thing leads to another, then another. And next thing you know, you're talking about central banking in Luxembourg.
It certainly does.
So, Sam, tell us a bit about what your role was as the chief economist at Avalon and where the energy space had a particular kind of focus there in that capacity.
Sure. So as a chief economist at Avalon, I was kind of responsible for keeping track of everything that happened both within Texas in terms of energy and more broadly the global space. And that became really interesting within the Avalon sphere, because Avalon is a firm that represents ultra high net worth individuals, mostly within Texas. And you can kind of extrapolate that into a number of people who have energy exposure broadly. So the majority of my job was typically to pay attention to what was going on in energy, where it was happening, and how it was happening. So it was a really fun time.
Now, in terms of a lot of those particular families and ultra high net worth folks that were in the energy space by nature being in Texas, was it pretty monolithic ideologically? Like, was this generally more right-wing oriented people that were pro oil and gas? And you know, I guess coming from a particular worldview where a lot of characteristics were shared, or was there diversity of opinion around the environmental aspects and political and economic aspects of oil and gas?
Well, that's kind of the interesting part of it was no and yes. No, in terms of, was it monolithic in terms of the way that they thought about oil and the future of oil and the future of energy? It wasn't. It was very much a diversified view in terms of, how do I take the wealth that I made in oil and how do I extrapolate that in some way into a much broader mindset around investing? Right. So that I think is underappreciated in terms of the idea of a Texas oil man, right? The Texas oil man does not necessarily think of it as oil one and that's it. It is very much a, how do I think about diversifying the oil aspect of my portfolio? Number two, It was a strange kind of mix of political views around oil, around climate change, around everything else that you might politically associate with oil. It wasn't just extreme right. It wasn't just extreme left, obviously. It was a very balanced type of view in terms of, my political view may be right leaning, but my portfolio needs to be a little less correlated with my political view. So I would say it's a little bit of a balance there.
I am not surprised to hear that, but I have a feeling a lot of people would be, because I think there's this sort of reputation out there that everybody in the oil and gas space all thinks the same, all has very similar views. And yet when you're dealing with a broad diversity of entrepreneurs, of economic actors, you know, even geographically, people act as if West Texas and East Texas are the same, and Oklahoma and North Texas are the same, and the Bakken and the, you know, Appalachian, and the, you know, when you look across the different oil territories of the United States, there comes with that a very diverse mix of cultural and political and even economic circumstances. But I suppose it seems to serve a leftist narrative that everyone's kind of coming about it from the same vantage point, which is somewhat kind of greedy and definitely environmentally naive and perhaps even environmentally sinister. And once they allow for nuance, it forces them to kind of have to alter that caricature a little bit. And yet your experience was that there was a lot of nuance amongst different oil and gas investors that you came into contact with.
Oh, certainly. An incredible amount of nuance between investors. But to your point on regionality, you know, there's an incredible difference between what goes on in the Bakken and what goes on in the Permian, right? The Permian is mostly drilling for oil. The Bakken, that's mainly gas, right? I mean, you're drilling for gas. If you're not drilling for gas, I'm sorry. But you have different objectives when you're going into different basins. You have different needs in terms of pipelines. You have different needs in terms of clarity from the EPA, from the different regulatory agencies. You have an incredibly different objective depending on where you're going and what you're doing. The other side of it is you also have a different mentality in terms of your investment objective, right? You're investing for incremental barrels of oil. You're investing for incremental barrel equivalents of natural gas. That's a very different type of time frame in terms of investing, number one, but also in terms of your return. Right. If you're a publicly traded company, you're in a lot of trouble if you're trying to drill short term in the Permian for oil relative to drilling for natural gas. Right. Natural gas gets kind of a pass right now from the ESG community. Oil does not. So you have a different mentality on that front. I don't know. And this is kind of the fun part. I don't know how that changes and when it changes, but as you begin to migrate into a different age, right, of whether it's ESG or whether it's some form of a secondary form of ESG, whatever that might be, call it a focus on E.
Yeah,
you're going to get some sort of weird turn, and that's where I think Texas gets a really interesting type of pass in a way. So does Pennsylvania. The other places where there's a lot of gas over oil. I think that's the way to think about it: is oil over gas.
Well, and so is that the primary distinction, is that there are some that are more focused in the crude space and others are more focused in natty gas, and that has some different political things that come with it, different environmental views. I mean, so I guess that's a good question, because I've been a very big proponent of natural gas for a long time. I've spoken about it on TV. I've rallied the cause of natty gas, the cleaner fuel. But, you know, I never for a moment in that advocacy of natural gas and the broader utility of natural gas liquids and the basic realization, I was arguing for the left to not lump natty gas in with other fossil fuels, because I thought it served more of a purpose for their objectives. But it never occurred to me that made me anti-crude. Is there a oil versus gas contention that you ran into in the kind of Texan markets?
Oh, yeah. So in to your point, it has very little to do with oil, right? So there's a huge anti-oil, anti-crude type movement. It doesn't tend to actually spew into the nat gas movement or drilling, etc. And that's kind of important, right? That's what heats homes in New England. That's what heats my house in Houston, which is freezing right now. The natural gas drilling side of things is much different than the oil side. It's not necessarily cleaner. It's not necessarily, in terms of drilling, it's not necessarily more proficient, but it's certainly a much more important part of the energy mix when it comes to keeping consumers cool in the summer and warm in the winter, right? Oil is a little less important on that front. It's much more important when it comes to driving my car or flying an airplane, but it's far less important in heating and cooling. It's far less important when it comes to, call it the traditional day-to-day homemaking type deal. What I love about the debate between oil and nat gas is that associated natural gas is one of the most wasted and most prevalent things that we have in the U.S. And quite frankly, it should be close to free. And if you look at U.S. to European differentials in energy pricing right now, you can kind of get a feel for why it is so important, right? You're talking $325, $350 for natural gas right now in the U.S., and you're talking, call it 5 to 10 times that in the European Union. And that is an incredibly important aspect of why the U.S. is different than Europe, that we have a very enclosed market when it comes to natural gas, when it comes to oil, et cetera, et cetera. And we can get into that more in a bit. But we have an incredible advantage in terms of heating our homes, cooling our homes, et cetera, than Europe ever will.
And so you would argue that that advantage we have versus Europe is more related to natty gas sufficiency than crude, but that within the United States, we have a certain energy capacity in both oil and gas that let me phrase it as a question instead of a statement. Should there be competitive, not in the marketplace? There definitely should be, right? There, I can see why both oil and gas producers would have different interests based on what their respective commodity has to say in a given market predicament. But from an ideological standpoint, should the cause of the natural gas producer be the cause of the crude oil producer and vice versa, especially in a day and age of fracking? Or is there a sort of distinction that we want to hold on to regarding, you know, what would animate each side ideologically?
Oof. So that's a tough one.
Because it strikes me as you're talking, I've never thought about this once in my life, that when I say I'm an all of the above energy guy, it's sort of a common thing for people to say politically on the right. I remember Giuliani saying it in 07 in the presidential primary. Rick Perry even said it, you know, when he was running in 2012. And it was always, Larry Kudlow says it all the time. He's an economic advisor with my business. And he talks all the time about, you know, well, I'm a all of the above guy, meaning we don't want to say wind and solar renewables have no place. But in the meantime, we also want cleaner and greater and cheaper oil, gas. Let's consider nuclear, et cetera, et cetera. So that all of the above rhetoric that a guy like me uses seems very consistent. But of course, I've never been an oil entrepreneur. I've never been a gas executive. So it strikes me that I'm saying it assuming everybody agrees, but is that not necessarily true that their separate market interests do not get in the way of a shared ideological interest? In other words, do some of these compete with each other ideologically as well?
They do, and that's kind of the interesting part, right? If you drill for oil, you're going to hit associated gas, right? So, and that's kind of the strange part, right? So if you want more gas to be produced, you can either go to gas-rich basins, which are typically South Texas, Eagle Ford-type deals that also have oil, or you can go to very rich gas and oil fields, which are in West Texas. And, you know, you can go to West Virginia, you can go to other places as well, but you're going to hit oil, you know, you're going to drill through coal, et cetera. You know, you're going to have these other things that are involved. And that is an incredibly important point, that if you want natural gas, you're also going to hit oil. And if you want oil, you're also going to hit natural gas. So if you incentivize oil pumping, you know, you're going to have flaring, right? We had this huge quote unquote problem with flaring in 2012 to 2014, right? Because you were drilling a lot and fracking a lot for oil in the Permian and other basins, which caused a lot of gas to be released, and you had to flare it, or you had to just release it into the air. So you generally flared it, you know, just for EPA reasons. But that is an incredibly important point, where if you're going to drill for natural gas, you're going to find oil, right? It's just a fact. And if you're drilling for oil, you're going to find natural gas.
Is that true in equal proportion, that where there is residue of gas out of oil, particularly I'm assuming you're talking about in a kind of horizontal drilling capacity, that the shale space, do they produce residue both in equal proportion to one another?
Oh, no. And to be honest, horizontal drilling, I know almost nothing about, but you know, the horizontal drilling, fracking, et cetera, that's going to produce the derivatives of natural gas, et cetera. So you're going to have that if you're going to drill in the U.S., because the vast majority of drilling is going to be vertical and fracked from here on out. So you're going to have a lot of gas coming out if you're looking for oil, just in general. So that's an important part of the conversation, that you're going to have these types of secondary, call it benefits, to everything as you move forward, which is a good thing, right? If you want cleaner fuel, you're going to have a lot of natural gas in the U.S., and you're going to have it in a way that allows you to also have oil byproducts, which are also in incredibly high demand, which nobody wants to talk about, on the sideline. So I don't think it's a bad thing, and it's just going to be there.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay. Let's take this to the next step then, in terms of where we are right now, within the movement of people that are pro oil or pro gas. Including the combination. Right now, there is a shared enemy, even if there's not all shared beliefs and shared market interest. You know, there's distinctions amongst their respective commodity, distinctions amongst their business interest. But if you are ESG progressive, they throw the S and the G there incoherently. I don't know what their concerns are with the social and governance structures of oil and gas. So let's just assume that they're trying to add a little alphabet soup, and yet the E is the real focus. The shared enemy is those who want to decarbonize immediately. And they wanted to do so by cutting off these oil and or gas companies from access to capital markets. Now, they want to do it in other ways, too, obviously, right? There's a regulatory state they want to enable their efforts. And there is taxation, the idea of a cap and trade, carbon tax, all sorts of different emission standards. There's a number of things they can do. But the major focus, regardless of the tactic, is that they do want the extinction of these companies. So the oil and gas folks face an existential threat. And the primary way that they seem to be able to move the needle is by cutting off their access to capital markets. And yet you were a chief economist at a large financial services firm in Texas. You and I both have significant access to where private credit and private equity is involved in the funding of oil and gas. But I guess I would ask you, do you believe that the environmentalists, the radical environmentalists, because I don't think this includes all of them, I don't want to paint with too broad a brush, but do you believe the radical environmentalists are winning in their effort to cut off capital markets from the oil and gas industry?
Ooh, so yes and no. I think they won in cutting off, call it the equity side, significantly. They cut off BlackRock, they cut off State Street, et cetera, et cetera. But what they didn't cut off was the broad swath of capital that wants to make money, right? So you cut off the index funds, you cut off the ESG funds, but you didn't cut off family offices, you didn't cut off hedge funds that nobody's going to check where they made their alpha from. Nobody really cares how they made their excess returns. And so I think what they did really was similar to, and I hate to use this, but similar to tobacco or similar to the, call it 1980s style activism around tobacco. What you really had was that type of dynamic where you tried to cut off funding, but all of a sudden it looks really attractive to people who really care about returns. And quite frankly, you know, if you want to talk about oil and gas and energy as being kind of the demons of the 21st century, you know, I would throw crypto and Bitcoin in there as by far, far more complicated and far worse entities than the oil and gas companies. But no, I think to your point, the oil and gas.
Sam, that's juicy stuff. So let's elaborate there. Explain a little more why you would see crypto as being more problematic than oil and gas for that agenda.
Yeah, so kind of two ways, right? So if you look at oil as a geopolitical and consumer-based commodity, right? And so you have a shutdown in Saudi Arabia, oil prices are going to spike. You have a consumer problem in the U.S., oil prices are going to fall. You know, that's kind of your dynamic, right? You can kind of just use those two things and kind of peg it as your, they call it things to look at for oil. If you want to look at Bitcoin, what you have to look at is where it's mined, how it's mined, and who's consuming it, right? So Kazakhstan, of all places, is 20% of mining for Bitcoin, and they shut down the internet. You have a huge problem with Bitcoin. That's a geopolitical risk. That is not dissimilar to oil, right? But it's the opposite front. Right, you have a geopolitical problem with oil. Oil prices go up because people are forced to consume it. I have to drive to the office. I have to buy oil. People don't have to buy Bitcoin, right? So you get the opposite reaction in Bitcoin. And I think that's the mentality that's kind of interesting between the two, is that oil, to a certain degree, is very much a geopolitical consumer, U.S. consumer, if you want to just break it down to its base components, commodity. Bitcoin is somewhat the same way, but in somewhat a different dynamic and very fun to look at from that angle. So it's a very interesting world when it comes to Fed raising rates. What does that do to oil? What does that do to rates? What does that do to crypto, et cetera, because it's going to have implications, and it's going to have implications across not just, you know, call it oil, natural gas, aviation fuel, et cetera. It's going to have implications across a wide-ranging number of places that people really haven't paid attention to in a really long time.
And so do you think that the reason that it seems a lot of the legislators on the left have focused all their regulatory efforts, all their kind of fire and brimstone messaging, all their ire, all their regulatory intentions at oil and gas, but we don't seem to yet hear a lot of this concern at the crypto space? Is that just a matter of time, or is there something ideological that causes them to play favorites? Because you're right, it certainly seems as if they wanted to be consistent, they would have something to kind of, I mean, I've noticed this, like, for example, with the amount of natural gas that's required to power the electricity that is behind the battery production of so much in the EV space, let's take a Tesla type example, that the left there doesn't seem to have the same concern. And yet I've never assumed that that's because they don't really care about carbon emissions. I think they do care about it. So it forces me to either think that they're being ignorant or that they're being selective because of a sort of totem pole of ideological priorities, like they're willing to kind of let certain things pass. What am I missing on this stuff? What, you know, other than just, are we supposed to say, oh yeah, they're just hypocrites, or is there more to it?
I don't think it's that they're hypocrites. I think it's that they miss how prevalent energy is in our system. Right. It's not just gasoline in a car. It's not just flying from point A to point B. It's the plastic in the car. It's the thread that puts together the seats in a car. I mean, the prevalence of oil in the global economy is incredible. And I don't think they've put together those pieces in terms of exactly how expensive that's going to be to replace within the supply chain. That replacement isn't just a couple of things, right? It's not just replacing fuel. It's not just replacing, the tires on my car. It's replacing an entire system that we have in place that produces everything that we use, right? Our cell phones, our computers, everything we know would be non-functional without oil. So until we begin to come to grips with the fact that it's not just fuel, it's not just how we get from point A to point B, it's how we talk from point A to point B, it's how we view each other from point A to point B. That is an incredible step in the decarbonization or the de-oilization of the economy. I mean, I wanted to paint my daughter's wall if purple. That's what she wanted. So I painted her wall purple. Her wall is painted purple with a petroleum-based product, right? And so until we begin to come to grips with how this transition actually is going to go, I don't think we can have an intelligent conversation about what it's going to cost governments, what it's going to cost consumers, and how much of a step function that is going to be in terms of price. Because we haven't come to that perspective of this isn't a one-time off, we're going to drive electric cars and everything is going to be great. You know, we're prepping, at least it feels like, for a world that says it's horrible to have any sort of hydrocarbon coming out of the ground that is included in anything. And quite frankly, if you want your Tesla painted, that is a hydrocarbon. So it's going to be a different world than I think a lot of people have contemplated.
But you had started off by saying that you think a lot of these people don't realize it. And I guess I'm wondering, when it comes to the selective ire, where you know the people driving big trucks are going to get the wrath of the progressive radicals, but those painting, those buying certain plastics and resins, those that have a more mainstream use of fossil fuels, that, as you rightly point out, is inescapable in modern society. Is it that they know that there is an audience and an enthusiastic, zealous audience for their message of limiting air travel and truck driving, but that once they start to mainstream decarbonization, that they won't keep their audience? So they're not ignorant themselves. They're politically wise to realize that their message will not take hold if people start to think they can't paint their daughter's bedroom.
Yes. So it's resonate over reasonable, right? The message resonates. The message isn't reasonable, right? I think that's kind of the message that they're giving. And it's a very weird place to be, right? If you look at truck drivers right now, if you try to recruit, this was a conversation I had a few weeks ago with a trucking company, you try to recruit somebody to be a new trucker, they say no. And the reason they say no is, hey, listen, Elon told me in 5 years, they're going to have them automated and I'm not going to have a job. So I need to go find something else to do. There's a true political side to it, but there's also a real job side to it, right? Where you have scared people out of being reasonable thinkers. I think you did a recent podcast with Steve, with Forbes, where he said it's a problem of education at some point. And I think this is a perfect example of that, right? We educated a few people to the level where they can convince others that this is a massive problem of epic proportions, and this is the solution, right? Whether or not that solution is reasonable doesn't matter. That is the point that we have kind of come to. To a certain degree, he also made, and I think this part was particularly important, he made the statement that, you know, you don't necessarily have to do a 4-year degree to be successful. That is very underrated within our society right now, where you can walk into a trucking company, and if you don't think that they're going to automate trucking completely in 5-10 years, you can make $1 million before they automate trucking. I mean, that's a pretty incredible place to be at right now. So I think it's a combination of people being educated to think that anything that comes out of the ESG movement is gospel, and to a degree, and people coming out of that movement in any way are deemed to be the enemy, right? So you've created a dichotomy that is very difficult to overcome.
Well, that's right. I mean, the whole thing is fascinating, although I guess sometimes it's more frustrating than fascinating. But maybe you and I, since we're a couple of finance guys and we're on a capital markets podcast, maybe we can do our best. I don't know if I'm capable of doing it. You're probably more balanced and mature than I am to separate those sort of societal and cultural considerations. But let's just look at oil and gas and the energy infrastructure needs of the country from a pure market set. You talked about how they've had luck at cutting off the public equity funding mechanisms to much of oil and gas, but they have found more opportunistic investors on the private market side. And I assume you were including both debt and equity in that.
Yes.
That bids up the cost of capital, doesn't it?
To a degree, but not necessarily a lot, right? Because you're pricing it against public markets. So you're not necessarily getting that bad of a rate off of...
But isn't there an illiquidity premium?
To a degree, but really not as much as you would think. So okay, probably one, maybe between 100 and 150 basis points. So you're not talking about a huge jump in capital. What I think is really interesting, and I'm going to run with this for a minute and cut me off whenever.
No, but go for it.
I think there's a really interesting dynamic between your old school publicly traded oil companies that want to be woke. And so, not going to name names, but your very large publicly traded guys that, you know, don't see the point in reinvesting in new projects, reinvesting in new wells, et cetera, in the private firms that can find capital, you know, finding capital, you know, banks might not want to lend, et cetera, but private capital does find its way in there, whether it's family offices, whether it is private banks, they will find a way to get funded, and they will find a way to get funded at a fairly good rate relative to your spreads. The private side of the market is doing very well right now, exploiting the opportunity to take the public land, you know, the publicly owned, publicly traded companies' lands, taking those, buying them, exploiting them, drilling them, etc. They're finding that to be incredibly profitable. And I feel like that's the story of American capitalism underneath the surface, where you have this very, very loud narrative up top that everyone who's actually drilling, actually on the surface, is pretty much ignoring. They do hear it. They do fear it to a degree. But they're still drilling. They're still investing. They're still exploring. It's going, in my opinion, to be a story of the transition from the publicly traded, the national oil companies, et cetera, to the privately held, privately funded oil extraction companies. And those are going to make a very pretty penny. And they're going to be able to self-finance at some point. You know, you're not, you know, if you're not exploring, if you're not ExxonMobil and putting $100 to $500 million into exploration over the next year, 2 years, you're not going to find new incremental wells to drill, right? So you're creating a scarcity in an era where scarcity is already there. It's a wild dynamic for the firms that don't have the scrutiny, don't have the funding needs, and can go out there and drill wells. It's a fantastic opportunity. And that's not even getting into MLPs and their opportunity.
Well, why don't we briefly, before we wrap up, go there, because we spent most of our time on the upstream side, but when you look at midstream, this is another area where I've always been confused, because ideologically, my understanding of the left's agenda was that they wanted decarbonization, they wanted safer processes around fossil fuel and emissions. And you get now to a midstream space and MLPs that largely focus in using pipelines to transport oil and gas. Now, I understand they don't like what's inside the pipelines. And I understand that there's concerns about leakage. And there were the kind of, I think, grossly misstated and misunderstood talk about methane emissions. But effectively, they would be the first to admit that truck and rail is a far less environmentally safe way of transporting oil and gas. Yet it doesn't seem that they've been any nicer to the midstream than the upstream. Am I right in my perception? And why are they like this? Again, is it just ignorance or is it something else?
Ooh, so you're 100% correct. I don't think it's ignorance. I think it's political expediency, right? It's a pretty low-hanging fruit, right? You're going to dig a giant trench through this beautiful land, blah, blah, blah. We hate you. That's a pretty easy narrative to pitch. The only problem there is that you have to have the ability to transfer energy from point A to point B. And you can do that via a truck that's burning diesel, or you can do that via a very efficient pipeline that's using just a giant compressor. It's pretty simple. But from an investment perspective, what we've learned over the last, call it 16 to 18 months, is we're not going to have many more pipelines built in the U.S., and if we do, they're going to be insanely expensive, which makes the existing pipelines incredibly important national treasures in terms of transporting energy from point A to point B. So the re-rating of the pipelines, I think, will be one of the more interesting narratives as we move forward, simply because if you can't build more of them, and you have to maintain them, and you have to put oil and gas into them, that makes them far more important than they were when, we could build four of these pipelines to New England instead of one. So I think that narrative is going to be incredibly important over the next 5 years.
So effectively what you're saying is that they're undervalued.
Oh, massively. Hey, if you can't build
and
more.
And that one of the things undervaluing them and giving opportunity for this greater accretion is the policymakers of the people that hate them, that they're leading to a great value creation by artificially constraining supply of their market segment.
Exactly. Now, there's two ways to make something incredibly, incredibly important. One, make it so nobody can build it. And two, try to regulate it out of existence. And you have both of those happening with pipelines. And that, to me, makes pipelines incredibly interesting. It's not like the U.S. has dropped off massively in terms of oil and gas and distillate output. We're still battling for number one globally, right? We're still way up there. It's not like pipelines are going anywhere anytime soon. It's not like, the U.S. is somehow going to pivot to having a new energy source for cars, planes, trucks, houses anytime soon. That, to me, is the low-hanging fruit of all of this, is the pipelines that have been kind of left in the dust, so to speak.
Well, I got to say, I think that we've opened up a couple other cans of worms. That means we're going to have to do this again, Sam, because there's so much more we could talk about. love your insights. Love you taking the time to do this, and I greatly appreciate it. So I will absolutely be in touch to reschedule another sit down, and we'll hash out a kind of follow-up on these items. I appreciate your expertise here. I appreciate you sharing your insights, and I hope you will join us again on the Capitol Record.
Well, David, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation. It was one that I think forces us to have to pick up again, because we really could have kept going and maybe even should have kept going. But time constraints being what they were, I think that that was the right place to end for now, as long as we can come back and continue drilling, if you see what I did there. Look forward to having Sam back on. Look forward to hearing your feedback, questions, comments, thoughts you have, and appreciate your continued efforts to rate us and review us, and most of all, subscribe so that it comes to your feed automatically. Better for us, better for you. Thank you for listening to the Capitol Record.